So on this auspicious occasion, I'd like to speak about what I've learned being a rabbi. I've actually been a pulpit rabbi longer than I've been a rabbi. Let me explain. In July 1996, for about 2 years, I was, I don't know how to describe this, a rabbinic impersonator, a rabbinical soloist. I served a small congregation, Temple Nerami in Camarillo. I always think of it as like a doctor. You're a doctor, you practice medicine for a few years, and then if you like it, you go to medical school. So I practiced being a rabbi for a few years. It seemed to work out, and so I went to rabbinical school. And in May of 2003, I was ordained a rabbi at the tender age of 55. I served Temple Nerami in Camarillo. I've been a community rabbi for the Jewish Federation of Ventura County. I had student pulpits in lots of places, and for the last 5 years, I have been your rabbi here at the Jewish community of Ojai. I actually keep track, and I have done I've officiated a total of 439 funerals. The most recent one was on Monday, and 118 weddings. Number 119 is this coming Saturday. In the Talmud, Rabbi Chanina remarked, "I have learned much from my teachers, more from my colleagues, and the most from my students. So I've learned a lot being your rabbi, and I thought it's only fair that I share it with you." And I seem to have... I have learned a truism that I share all the time, I think I may have even shared last night, from Helen Telushkin, that the only perfectly happy people I know, people without serious problems, are people I don't know very well. I heard this before becoming a rabbi, but now I've had the honor of knowing you so many of you so well. I've learned that every life has tragedy, has deep pain, but well-lived lives also have deep joy. I've learned the truth that religion is indeed a crutch. That phrase is often used to criticize religion, but I've actually learned to use it as a praise of religion. A crutch is a wonderful thing if you've got a bad leg. The problem is not how to be more Jewish. The problem is how to dance the dance of life, especially when you are deeply wounded. It reminds me of our name Yisrael, and that Jacob has his name changed to Israel when he struggles with God and with an angel. And he is, in fact, wounded. His name actually means one who wrestles with God. So if you've got problems with God and struggle with the idea of the God, welcome to the club. The name of our club is the God Wrestlers. And indeed, Jacob, in his wrestling with God, Yisrael, in his wrestling with God, has his hip wounded. And indeed, we commemorate that wound by making that particular part of the body of an animal not kosher. I've learned so many lessons. I've learned lessons from funerals. 4 years ago, you can find it on my website, I gave a talk called What I'm Learning About Life from Funerals. I take notes when I prepare for eulogies, and then I listen very carefully and take further notes as people are speaking. What do people talk about in the few minutes allotted to them when they summarize how they feel about their beloved spouse, a sibling, a parent, a grandparent, and a great-grandparent? You know, I almost never hear about professional or business success, about how much money or how many houses or cars or boats or motorcycles someone has amassed. And now let me tell you what I do hear that touches me most. A woman speaking when she was a child about a parent who told her the ugly duckling story over and over again to boost her young self-image. About the warmth and joy of working together with a grandparent on a project, any project, just to be with him or her. About a mom whose greatest skill was making do, finding quarters in phone booths for snacks, saving the plastic from the cleaners to be used when it rains, and always coming up with some small gift, even when it was clearly not in the budget. But here's my favorite. A mom who would clean up meticulously. There's something with the system in the back, but I can be loud. A mom who would clean up meticulously after parties, just in case, someone would rob the house after the party, she didn't want to get the idea that she was that the mom was a bad housekeeper. This is a new and I think amazing take on where on the wear clean underwear story. Let me see if I can make it. You get the idea. I've learned the sweetness of a child's hug. I will never forget once walking through Adat Elohim with Robin Feldman, who was the early childhood educator at the time. And just all these little kids coming up and hugging her. Hello, Miss Robin. And she was just inundated with hugs. Another example from Camarillo, a little girl then, I think 3-4 years old, named Shira Santer. She was absolutely adorable. And there was a bar mitzvah, and she was sitting in the front, but she and her dad had to go off and do something else. So in the middle of the bar mitzvah, she comes up, she runs up to the bima, gives me a big hug, and she says, I'm sorry, Rabbi, we have to leave now. And then, of course, this may not be rabbinic, but my granddaughters. I probably shouldn't start on this because I might never stop. But I'll tell you one quick story. My first visit to Toys R Us of blessed memory with my then 3-year-old granddaughter. We had 3 glorious hours of walking around and playing with the toys and trying different toys. And then, of course, when it was time to leave, truth be told, there was really a minor but significant temper tantrum, a crying fit. But eventually, I calmed down pretty well when Sonia buckled me into my car seat. I've learned the times I felt like I've truly been God's hands, and surprisingly enough, in difficult funerals. And one comes to mind very shortly after my ordination, a 16-year-old, the son of a founding member of our congregation in Camarillo, was killed in a car accident. And I remember calling my rabbi, Alan Greenbaum, and asking him, how do I handle this? What in the world am I going to do? And he gave me some advice, but I was terrified. But I found as I worked with the family, no, it's just going in and out. I found as I worked with the family that it was astounding. I felt like I was the hands of God giving comfort and healing to this family in this incredibly difficult time. The funeral that followed was attended by some 800 teenagers who had lost their friend. I never felt so clearly that I was doing holy work. I've learned the power of being a rabbi. I've also learned some pretty amazing ideas of what people will believe. Okay, I have this here. Yes, I have this here. It's a little show and tell. When I first joined the temple in Camarillo, they didn't have glass in the ark doors. So I told this young person, bat mitzvah student, the first year when a rabbi goes to a temple, you take the glass out of the ark doors so the rabbi develops a closer association with the Torah. And of course, she was nodding sagely. I hasten to add that I actually did tell her the truth. So if you think that this is just a matter of children being gullible, I want to show you something. There's actually one other story. Once, some of you know I'm a chaplain for the fire department. So I was once talking to a group of people and saying, you know, there's one odd rule about having a rabbi be a chaplain for the fire department. We are not allowed to be called to fires during Hanukkah because of the fear that the building might burn for 8 days. And the group nodded, very safe. I mean, it's frightening what people believe. And then at the other extreme, there was the time when Sonia's mother, Lisa of blessed memory, was visiting at our house. And I went to take out the garbage. And she was shocked. She's from Casablanca, much more traditional world. She was shocked that the rabbi was taking out the garbage. I know you find it shocking too. I have learned the power of teaching. You never know when teachings will stick with people. A bar mitzvah student having some trouble saying to me, don't let the best be the enemy of the good, something I say a lot. A teaching during service, whenever I lead a bar mitzvah, I know that there are many people in the congregation that are not Jewish, that are not so well-versed in Judaism, and so I teach continually. One of the things I teach is that the Amidah, the standing prayer, the one that begins, Baruch Atah Adonai Eloheinu ve'Elohei Avoteinu, and so on, took the place of animal sacrifice at the temple. So we sacrificed animals three times a day. Now we say this prayer traditionally three times a day. And on two occasions, the Zaidi, the grandfather of the bar mitzvah child, would come up to me in tears, saying, I've been praying this prayer three times a day, every day of my life since I'm 3 years old, and no one ever told me why. I love seeing people years later and having them tell me what I've taught or what I've talked about in sermons that most touch them. I especially love it when they repeat a key point of one of my sermons that I don't remember saying. I really like it when they talk about a key point in one of my sermons that changed their life that I know I didn't say because I don't agree with it. I've learned and have taught that science and religion are compatible. I always use the reference to the boiling tea kettle. Came down this, well, not this morning, but on a regular morning, and the water was boiling, the tea kettle was boiling on the stove. Why was the tea kettle boiling? And people will, of course, give the answer, you know, that the heat heated the water and so on. But the other answer, which takes people a little longer to come up with, is because Sonia wanted tea. So why is there a universe? One set of answers has to do with cosmology and physics. And the other answer is because God wanted a universe. I love the quote from Jonathan Sacks, former chief rabbi of Great Britain. Science takes things apart to see how they work. Religion puts things together to see what they mean. I learned the confidence to invent rituals, such as in my, you know, in Camarillo, unrolling the entire Torah around the room. It's used now quite commonly. And then with respect to this Torah, at a huge Simchat Torah celebration, by the way, we're having it, another one at Temple Beit Torah, I think a week from this Sunday, of taking this Torah around the congregation, as I did once here, without its cover, so that people could feel the velvet-like vellum of this 300-year-old text. I learned how easy it is to be misunderstood. The very first time I was to give a high holiday sermon, I ran it by the president of the temple. And I was talking about how Christians and Jews get along together. And she pointed out something that she said, I know what you're saying, but you are going to be misunderstood. You cannot say this. And my first instinct was said, well, who's the rabbi around here? Then I remembered I wasn't actually a rabbi at the time. And then when I calmed down a little bit, I realized she was absolutely right. I've learned how wonderfully kind can be, a people can be. At one of my first funerals, Irv Dubin of blessed memory came up to me. I was so taken with the ceremony of folding the flag at the funeral that Irv Dubin, a community elder, came up to me and asked me a question toward the end of the funeral and said, Rabbi, do you think we should say the Kaddish? Rather than saying, Rabbi, you forgot to say the Kaddish. He posed it as a serious question. I remember the outpouring of love at my ordination, when my late wife Carol died, when my stepson Mark died, when Sonia and I married, and at other times. I've learned how sometimes people can be thoughtlessly cruel. I once wrote in an article about the cruelest thing you can do to your rabbi, if you're wondering about this, is to ask the rabbi, do you remember my name? It's very thoughtful to say, you know, I'm, and then state your name, even if you're pretty sure the rabbi remembers your name. And on that vein, I always remember the idea that I might be thoughtlessly cruel or insensitive being my greatest fear. When I interviewed at Hebrew Union College, they asked me, what was your greatest concern about becoming a rabbi? And it was that I might be in a rush, you know, I might have car problems, I might have back problems, I might have family problems, who knows, at the end of a Shabbat, and I might kind of rush out the door smiling at everyone, and someone might be in the congregation who really needed to speak with me. I remember once at a high holiday, service in Camarillo, where I was not only responsible for preparing the sermons and the service, but also to keep the air conditioning working, and even once, just before Rosh Hashanah, plunging out the toilets. By the way, that is one of my skills. My father was a plumber, and I really know toilets. Bet you never heard that in a Yom Kippur sermon before. So this one person said to me, sitting next to his elderly mom, and says, I want to know why you disrespected my mother. And I said, what are you talking about? And she said, well, my mother was going to say, was looking to say hello to you, and you walked by her. And on one level, you know, I asked them, what motive could I possibly have for disrespecting your mother? But on another level, I really appreciated it, because one of the greatest gifts you can give to your rabbi is to let us know when we have failed in some way. Many people are intimidated by the rabbi, and therefore we don't get to hear when there are problems until, you know, they say, oh, by the way, don't bother coming in next week. So it's really helpful to let us know when we are not doing so well. Which brings me to what is perhaps the deepest and most painful truth that I've learned. We are each a moment away from nightmare. It may be a diagnosis, it may be an accident, a phone call, a letter, an email, so many things. Life and health are precious because they are not permanent. This is really the point, as I've said over and over again, of Yom Kippur. Maybe I've told this story in prior years, the little village in the old country, where the rabbi is trying to make this point on Yom Kippur, and he says with great fervor to the congregation, everyone from this village will die. And the people are appropriately chastened and get to thinking, except for one guy sitting in the front who is smiling and grinning, and nothing bothers this guy. And later, when the people are walking out, the rabbi couldn't help himself. I said, I noticed when I mentioned this serious point that everyone in this village will die, it didn't seem to affect you at all. He said, I'm not from this village. The 90th Psalm teaches us to count our days so that we may get a heart of wisdom. Don't put off till someday or till you get around to it. The difficult things you must do, the work, the mitzvah, the healing, the forgiveness sought, and the forgiveness granted. And don't put off enjoying the pleasures of life. I gave a sermon, checking my notes, in 2009, on Erev Rosh Hashanah, about the seven things that God will ask us when we meet God in heaven. It's a book by Wolpe, David Wolpe. And one of the things I especially love to focus on is the question God will ask, were there earthly pleasures permitted to you that you did not enjoy? Sorry, the word permitted is still in there. They tell another story about the head of a yeshiva in the old country who one day decided, we are going this week to hike the Alps. And this man was a man of letters, a scholar, and his students were dumbfounded. They never heard that the rabbi even liked the outdoors. And they asked him, Rabbi, why? And he said, I just thought that when I meet God and God asks me, Nu, so what did you think of my Alps? I would have nothing to say. It seems to me that you need three things for happiness in life: health, time, and resources. If you are blessed to have all these things, enjoy them now, because these are the good old days. There will be a time when you may not have all three of them. I'll close with what I have learned is the secret of life, and that is gratitude. Life is unfair. Most of us would agree with that idea. But we should be grateful that life is unfair, because we have so much more than our fair share of the good things of life. If we could reduce the world's population to a village of precisely 100 people, with all the existing human ratios remaining the same, the demographics would look something like this. It's a few years old, maybe off by one or two. The village would have 61 Asians, 13 Africans, 12 Europeans, 9 Latin Americans, and 5 from the United States and Canada. 50 would be male and 50 female. 75 would be non-white and 25 Caucasian. 67 would be non-Christian, 33 would be Christian, and 0.2%, or about 1/3 of a pound of one person, would be Jewish. 80 would live in substandard housing, 80 of the 100. 16 would be unable to read or write. 50 would be malnourished, and one dying of starvation. 33 would be without access to a safe water supply. 39 would lack access to improved sanitation. 24 would not have any electricity. And of the 76 who do have electricity, most would use it only at night for a light. This number probably has gone up a little bit, but 8 people would have access to the internet. 1 would have a college education. 5 people would control 32% of the entire world's wealth, and all 5 would be U.S. citizens. 48 would live on less than $2 a day, and 20 would live on less than $1 a day. Yes, life is unfair, but we are blessed with more, far more, than our fair share. The trick is to realize that you are so blessed. This is another old statistic I came across. Of everyone in the world who has ever lived in history to age 65 or older, 2/3 of them are alive today. Some of you will remember my mustard sermon in which I talked about going into a supermarket, and instead of just sort of being overwhelmed with having to shop and the expense and schlepping and so on, if you realize that in a world where there is so much malnutrition and throughout history where people have never, for the most part, have had enough to eat, here is everything laid out for you, stacked in cans. You know, I always talk about how the broccoli gets spritzed with water, and sometimes they even have thunder, so they should think they're still in the garden growing. And then I close this sermonic idea by going to where they sell the mustard. So once in Gelson's, I counted how many different choices I had for mustard. I'm pretty sure I could live without mustard. I know I would be perfectly happy with deli mustard. That day in Gelson's, I counted 39 choices of mustard. The Grey Poupon and the Coarse Grind and so on. So a few years later, I gave the same sermon to a different group, and I didn't want to just use the mustard, so I went to Whole Foods and counted olive oil. Think for a moment what you might expect in choices from olive oil. That day, I counted 92 choices of olive oil in Whole Foods. Some flavored, not so flavored, virgin, extra virgin, a little slutty. I never quite understood what a virgin olive oil is. But if you think of the idea of a God who so loves us that not only gives us clean, wonderful food to eat, but 39 choices of mustard and 92 choices of olive oil, the response to that ought to be gratitude. But almost instantly, the response needs to be, how do I repay God? And our understanding is we repay God by sharing what we have. Saying thanks in Hebrew and English can rewire your brain. It rewired mine. So you see before you a very happy man, a very happy rabbi. I am blessed with health, with time, with resources, and more important, with meaningful work to do. I am blessed to live in an amazing country at an amazing time in history. I am blessed to live in this amazing community. I'm blessed to have many wonderful friends, and the list just seems to grow. I'm blessed to have a family whom I love and who I believe loves me. And as I wrote in the dedication of my book, I'm blessed to have my wonderful wife, Sonia, who sustained me through the worst and leads me to the best. May the Holy One of Blessings grant me continued years with all of the above, and grant you the blessings and gifts that exceed my prayers for you and exceed the prayers of those who love you well. May you have a tzom kal, an easy fast. Gemar chatima tova. May you be sealed this evening for a wonderful year, indeed for many wonderful years, in my boss's Sefer HaChaim, the Book of Life. And we'll say together, Amen. And we will turn to page 293.